And now it's time for the Earth First Update, all the environmental news you can use. Uncle Dennis here at Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.3 and www.freakradio.org. On Thursday, February 11th, want to ask you to have a pencil and paper handy so you can write down names, addresses, telephone numbers, web pages, all the information you need to take action. Let's start with our announcements. The California Native Plant Society, Santa Cruz County Chapter Habitat Restoration Team is having a restoration this Saturday, February 13th, from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. at Quail Hollow Ranch County Park. Well, we had the rain we hoped for, and now we need to get some appreciable broom pulling done at Quail Hollow for the next couple of projects. Join us this Saturday and give a little heart to nature. And once again, that's Saturday, February 13th from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. at Quail Hollow Ranch County Park. Take Graham Hill Road north from Santa Cruz. As you come down into Felton, take the first right up East Ziani Road for about 2 miles. Turn left on Quail Hollow Road. The park entrance is a half mile up on the right. Meet in the gravel parking lot, and let me tell you about the Habitat Restoration Team. They're a volunteer group working to restore native habitat in the parks and protected lands of Santa Cruz County. The program provides an opportunity for people to learn about the natural systems that surround them while helping to restore special and wild places. No prior work experience is necessary. Just show up at the park. They welcome individual volunteers from 8 to 80. Wear comfortable layered clothing, bring something to drink, and lots of enthusiasm. They work rain or shine. It should be a nice day on Saturday. But if things get particularly unpleasant, they'll call it a day. Tools are provided. Bring those gloves and your water. For more information, contact the program leader, Linda. Her number, 831-462-4041. That's 831-462-4041. Or contact her by email at redwdrn@packbell.net. That's redwdrn@packbell.net. Or visit their webpage at www.cruisecnps.org. And the Buffalo Field Campaign's Week of Action is coming up next week, starting February 15th. There'll be all kinds of things going on in and around Montana and Yellowstone National Park concerning buffalo. So if you haven't gotten there yet, you still have a couple of days to make your way to West Yellowstone and start to get involved in all the Buffalo Field Campaign's Week of Action. For all that information, go to their webpage, www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. And if you have a donation for the Buffalo Field Campaign, send it to P.O. Box 957, West Yellowstone, Montana, the zip code 59758. If you have any questions, give them a call at 406-646-0070. You can find out all this information and more at www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. The Buffalo Field Campaign is the only group working in the field every day in defense of the last wild buffalo in the United States. And the Earth First Journal wants to remind you that the Winter Earth First newsletter is out. Go to their webpage, www.earthfirstjournal.org. That's www.earthfirstjournal.org, where you can download and print up copies for yourself and your friends. News out of Idaho isn't too good. Wilderness Watch News tells us that federal agents at the behest of Idaho Department of Fish and Game killed 20 wolves since the 1st of February in a remote and rugged areas of the Clearwater National Forest in Idaho. The Federal Wildlife Services Agency aerially gunned down 20 wolves in the so-called Lolo Zone, which includes part of the Selway Bitterroot Wilderness, though we don't believe the aerial gunning actually occurred in the wilderness areas. This is the latest in Idaho's long and unrelenting war on wolves. As you already know, the state recently helicoptered into the Frank Church River of No Return Wilderness and accidentally and illegally collared 4 wolves, while also illegally collaring elk, a plan that Wilderness Watch is challenging in the courts. Wilderness Watch took the Forest Service to court for allowing the Idaho Department of Fish and Game to fly in and capture and collar wolves in the same wilderness back in 2010. And we fought the Forest Service when 2 winters ago it allowed Idaho Department of Fish and Game to hire a contract hunter and trapper who killed 9 wolves in the Frank Church River of No Return Wilderness before being shut down. We're sure this won't be the state's last effort to exterminate wolves and violate the wilderness with helicopters. Wilderness Watch will continue continue to fight to protect the wild creatures and the wilderness they inhabit. For more information, go to www.wildernesswatch.org. Environmental groups sue to stop federal killings of wolves in Oregon. In this story by Courtney Sherwood, with editing by Eric M. Johnson and Peter Cooney, World Environment News, Thomson Reuters. Environmentalists sued a branch of the U.S. Department of Agriculture in a bid to block federal agents from carrying out targeted killings of gray wolves in Oregon as debate simmers over protections afforded the animals in the wild. The lawsuit against the USDA's Wildlife Services Agency came 2 months after a U.S. judge in neighboring Washington state ruled the federal agency's environmental assessment of its work was inadequate and blocked wolf kills in Washington. The environmental analysis they put forth for both Washington and Oregon were virtually identical, which is part of the reason we don't think they did a meaningful analysis in Oregon, said Nick Cady, legal director of Cascadia Wildlands, one of five groups suing to block the wolf culling program. The same conservation group sued in Washington state case. Gray wolves, native to Oregon but wiped out in the state by an eradication campaign in the early 20th century, returned in 2008 and have now spread out to multiple parts of Oregon. Wolves killed at least 30 sheep and cows in Oregon in 2014, according to state figures, and ranchers and hunters have been lobbying for more freedom to kill the predators in a long-standing feud over the level of protection for carnivorous canids. In Oregon, welfare advocates say Wildlife Services has not shown it is necessary to kill wolves instead of using non-lethal control methods, according to the complaint filed at the U.S. court in Oregon. Wildlife Services officials did not immediately respond to a request for comment. They have previously said agency policy prohibited them from discussing pending litigation. On their website, the agency said it provides federal leadership and expertise to resolve wildlife conflicts to allow people and wildlife to coexist. There is no imminent plan for the agency to kill wolves in Oregon, 80 of which roam around the wilds in 16 packs, Katie said. In 2012, Wildlife Services was chosen as the wolf-killing agency for Oregon. It has not killed any wolves since then, as the state has not asked it to do so. Wildlife officials last year removed all wolves from state endangered species protections except for a portion of the west side of the state that are still protected under the U.S. Endangered Species Act and therefore will not be targeted. And a presidential task force takes bold steps to address illegal, unreported, and unregulated fishing and seafood fraud. The Presidential Task Force on Combating Illegal, Unreported, and Unregulated Fishing and Seafood Fraud released a proposed rule aimed at tackling these problems in the United States. The rule, which is open for public comment for the next 60 days, proposed new requirements for seafood, including requiring traceability at the first point of entry into U.S. commerce for a select number of species considered at risk of IUU and seafood fraud. Oceana argues, however, that the new rule is missing critical components to stop IUU fishing and seafood fraud, and that full chain traceability for all U.S. seafood is a must to ensure that it is safe, legally caught, and honestly labeled. Oceana's senior campaign director, Beth Lowell, released the following statement. Oceana welcomes the proposed rule as a first step in fighting illegal fishing and seafood fraud. However, the steps outlined will not fully solve these problems. We encourage the administration to include the three key components in the final rule. It needs to apply to all seafood. Products need to be traced throughout the entire supply chain to the final point of sale. And if there is a phased-in implementation process, there must be a concrete timeline to expand the rule to all species and extend traceability from boat to plate in the final rule. Illegal fishing is a dirty business that operates outside the rule of law, hurting conservation efforts in addition to being associated with human trafficking, forced labor, and other illegal activity. With more than 1,800 species of seafood available for sale in the United States, limiting traceability to only a group of at-risk seafood leaves the rest of the seafood supply chain unguarded. In the proposed rule, the new tracking requirements stop at the first point of entry into the United States commerce. Requiring documentation at the first point of entry into U.S. commerce may protect seafood buyers from purchasing some products caught in IUU fishing, but it does not stop seafood fraud, which can happen anywhere throughout the supply chain, even within U.S. borders. Oceana urges the administration to strengthen requirements in the proposed rule. The United States should build upon its leadership to stop IUU fishing and seafood fraud by issuing the strongest rule possible that protects consumers, fishermen, seafood businesses, and the oceans. A roadmap to achieving full chain traceability for all seafood would ensure that all products are safe, legally caught, and honestly labeled. In 2014, Oceana conducted the most current and comprehensive review of seafood fraud literature to date, compiling 103 studies in 29 countries and on all continents except Antarctica. Every study found some level of seafood fraud, demonstrating that it is not just an issue that narrowly affects a handful of species or regions. In the U.S. alone, 50 different types of seafood have been found mislabeled, with over 150 species substituted in their place. The U.S. currently imports more than 90% of its seafood, yet a recent study found that between 20 and 32% of all wild-caught seafood crossing our borders comes from pirate fishing. Oceana's investigations of shrimp, fish, crab cakes, and most recently salmon in retail markets and restaurants found that, on average, one-third of the seafood examined in this study was mislabeled. The product listed on the label or menu was different than what the buyer thought they were purchasing, often less desirable and lower-priced species. Oceana studies show that all seafood is at risk of seafood fraud and illegal fishing. Oceana has observed threatened species being sold as more sustainable, expensive varieties replaced with cheaper alternatives, and fish that can cause illness substituted in places of those that are safe to eat. The task force and final rule is expected to be released in the fall of 2016. To learn more about Oceana's campaign to stop seafood fraud, please visit www.oceana.org/seafoodfraud. That's Oceana, OCEANA.org/seafoodfraud. And crackdown on illegal poachers continues in Antarctica. Internationally wanted toothfish poaching vessel, the Kunlun, has been detained in Senegal in this story from the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society Australia. The crackdown on poachers in the Southern Ocean continues with news that authorities in Senegal, West Africa, have detained the internationally wanted toothfish poaching vessel, Kunlun. Reports allege that the Kunlun had previously falsified its registry, claiming Indonesia as its flag state. This allowed the vessel to be detained in Senegal on formalities regarding its certification and flag status. Out of the six known toothfish poaching vessels, which Sea Shepherds calls the Bandit Six, five are now out of action. Only one, the Viking, remains at large. Sea Ship's flagship, the Steve Irwin, will now continue to target the Viking as part of its current Southern Ocean Defense Campaign, Operation Icefish 2015-16. Captain of the Steve Irwin, Sid Chakravarti, said, "A continued strong commitment by state authorities across the world, heralded by the actions of Interpol's Project Scale, has ensured that another toothfish poacher has been detained." International cooperation, spearheaded by two Southern Ocean campaigns by Sea Shepherd, has broken the back of organized crime syndicates operating these vessels. Cooperation between entities is a must in the work to be done to tackle illegal, unreported, and unregulated fishing. The Kunlun has a long history of IUU fishing and is believed to have links to known Spanish crime syndicate Vidal Armadores. In January 2015, the vessel was one of three illegal fishing boats which brazenly fished in the presence of the New Zealand Navy after they were found using banned bottom gill nets in Australian waters in the Southern Ocean. In February of 2015, the Kunlun was again intercepted inside Australian waters, this time by the Sea Shepherd ship San Simon, which at the time was under the command of Captain Chakravarti. The Sam Simon then engaged in an 8-day pursuit of the poaching vessel, chasing it out of its hunting grounds in the Southern Ocean. Later that same month, Australian Customs and Border Protection officers boarded the Kunlun in waters near the Cocos, also known as Keeling Islands. Following the boarding, the vessel was able to carry on to Southeast Asia with its illegal catch and gear. Then in March, the Kunlun was detained in Phuket, Thailand, when it attempted to offload 182 tons of illegally caught Patagonian toothfish declared to Thai customs as grouper. Given the limited application of Thailand's national laws to international fisheries crimes, the vessel was subsequently reloaded with the illegal catch and was kept at anchor for 5 months. Citing the first possible opportunity, The vessel eluded local Thai authorities and escaped from custody on September 8, 2015. Since that time, there have been concerns about the vessel offloading its catch and returning to Antarctica. However, with the detention in Senegal, it is confirmed that Kunlun, which has been now renamed the Asian Warrior, did not return to the Southern Ocean after it was pursued by the San Simon last February. In previous years, illegal vessels would simply change their names and flags at will and use international loopholes and the lack of international cooperation to survive and remain in operation, said Captain Chakravarti. It is incredibly satisfying to know that the Kunlun, which was chased out of the Southern Ocean by my vessel in February of 2015, has been unable to resume its illegal fishing operations. The work done by Sea Shepherd completes and at times fills the gaps in the work of governments, which are restricted by outdated legal conventions such as the UNCLOS, he concluded. For more information, please visit www.seashepherd.org.au. And a historic deal has been reached to protect Canadian rainforests from logging. In this story by Julie Gordon, editing by Bruce Wallace, Michael Perry, and Richard Chang, World Environment News, Thomson Reuters. Killer whales are at risk of extinction off industrialized regions of Europe from poisonous chemicals banned years ago that are still leaching into the oceans, scientists said recently. British Columbia has unveiled an historic agreement to protect a massive swath of rainforest along its coastline, having reached a deal that marries the interests of First Nations, the logging industry, and environmentalists after a decade of often tense negotiations. Under the agreement, about 85% of forests within the Great Bear Rainforest will be protected, and another 15% available for logging under the most stringent standards in North America, environmental groups involved in the talks said. The Great Bear Rainforest is one of the world's largest temperate rainforests and the habitat of the spirit bear, a rare species of black bear with white fur and claws. It is also home to 26 Aboriginal groups known as First Nations. The Great Bear Rainforest, there's no question, it's a jewel in the crown of magnificent landscapes in British Columbia, Premier Christy Clark said in an event. She added that the landmark agreement would protect more old and second-growth forest while still ensuring economic opportunities for local Aboriginals and communities. The province is expected to enshrine the new measures into law in the spring. The Great Bear Rainforest, which includes waterways, forests, and mountains, covers 6.4 million hectares of the province's coast. That would be around 15 million acres. More than half its surface is forest, including 2.3 million hectares, about 6 million acres, of old growth, which stores high levels of captured carbon. In the 1990s, frustrated over what they saw as the destructive forest practices on their traditional lands, First Nations partnered with environmentalists to fight back against logging companies blockading roads and protesting. By the early 2000s, environmental groups and industry players, including Interfor Corp, Western Forest Products, Inc., and Catalyst Paper Corp, had started talks. At the same time, the government began negotiating with the Coastal First Nations and Nanwakolas Council. The final agreements reached more than a decade later will deliver certainty for coastal forests, local communities, and jobs for years to come, Rick Jeffrey, chief executive of industry advocate Coast Forest Products Association, said in a statement. The deal would also end the commercial grizzly bear hunt within First Nations territories, though other existing tourism-related businesses will not be affected. Our leaders understand our well-being is connected with the well-being of our lands and waters, said Chief Marilyn Slett, president of Coastal First Nations. If we use our knowledge and our wisdom to look after our lands and waters and communities, they will look after us into the future. The announcement comes nearly 2 years after a landmark Supreme Court decision that granted title to a vast swath of British Columbia's interior to the Tsleil-Waututh First Nations, who had gone to court to stop logging on their traditional lands. That decision has bolstered First Nations across the province, who now have a legal precedent for fighting development on their territories. And logging protesters will be charged under Tasmania's anti-protest law, the first that has happened in this story from The Guardian, as found on the Earth First Newswire. Two healthcare workers protesting against the clear-cutting of native forests in Tasmania have become the first people charged under that state's controversial anti-protest laws. John Henshaw, 66, and Jessica Hoyt, 35, were in a group of 9 protesters who walked onto a forestry Tasmania land at Laponia, 37 kilometers from Burnie in northwest Tasmania. Earlier this month, Forestry Tasmania bulldozers moved into the area, which is home to the endangered Tasmanian giant freshwater lobster, and according to locals, has a population of disease-free Tasmanian devils. The land is part of a long-standing forestry area and has been selectively logged before, but the current harvesting plan is set to clear-cut 49 hectares, about 110 acres. Forestry-owned land can be divided into areas logged one at a time, usually over the course of a year. Henshaw, retired anesthetist, was arrested and charged in an offense under the Workplaces Protection from Protesters Act 2014 because he allegedly failed to comply with a direction from police to leave the site. He faces a fine of up to $10,000. 5 other people left when asked by police, and 3 more, including Hoyt, were escorted from the site by police and given an infringement notice, which meant that they would be arrested if they staged another protest in an active forestry area or any other area considered to be a workplace within 3 months. Hoyt was arrested when she returned to a different area of the forest. Hoyt's mother, Barbara, told Guardian Australia the arrest went against Forestry Minister Paul Harris's promise the legislation would not target mom and dad protesters. Hoyt, a registered nurse, has a 3-year-old daughter and is a stepmother to a teenager. The first draft of the anti-protest law was amended after criticism from the UN, but constitutional law experts said it remained vulnerable to high court challenges. "We are not activists. This is our home, our backyard," Barbara Hoyt said. Jess rides horses there, and she believes it's wrong to log it, and it is wrong. The Hoyts and Henshaws are part of the Forests of Laponia Action Group, which sprung from a local community last year when plans to log the area were announced. About 70 people have been gathering at the entrance to the forest area during the past week to mark their opposition to the logging, and Barbara Hoyt said those who did walk on site did so peacefully with the intention of hanging around until the police arrived and asked them to move on. Workplace safety rules mean the bulldozers which drive the clear felling can't operate until the protesters leave. They are not padlocking themselves to forestry machinery, a common practice in the episodic battle between environmentalists and industry in Tasmania. "It is a peaceful community process, and the police have been really good in the circumstances when no one really knows how the new law applies," Barbara Hoyt said. "The police think it's stupid and ridiculous, and all of them have been so supportive of us." Harris defended the use of the anti-protest laws, releasing a statement that says Tasmanian government has a strong supporter of free speech and the right to protest, and it was very disappointing that some people yesterday chose to allegedly break the law. His comments came as the Forestry Tasmania chairman, Bob Annells, announced his retirement from the board of the government-owned company. 3 other board members retired at the same time. Tasmanian Green Senator Nick McKim, who visited the Laponia protesters, said Annell's decision not to seek another term was significant because Annells was a vocal supporter of Tasmania Forest Agreement, torn up in 2014 as the first act of the Hodgman Liberal government. "This blowing up in Paul Harris's face. He has got what it looks like a board crisis at Forestry Tasmania. At the same time, his legislation, which was designed to scare people out of protesting, is not happening," McKim told Guardian Australia. "They have definitely restarted the forest wars in Tasmania, and they will reap what they sow." If you want further information, go to www.earthfirstgeneral.org/newswire. And finally, some good news for manatees and green sea turtles in this story by Merritt Kennedy of NPR, as found on the Earth First Newswire. West Indian manatees and some colonies of green sea turtles have been in danger of extinction for decades, but scientists have some good news about the much-beloved sea creatures, which both have their largest U.S. populations in Florida. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service says West Indian manatee should be reclassified from endangered to the improved status of threatened. The agency says threats to manatees are being addressed and they are responding with major population growth. Conservation officials say they counted only 1,267 manatees in Florida when aerial surveys began in 1991. Now the state hosts more than 6,300 manatees. The Fish and Wildlife Service puts the total worldwide population at about 13,000. The manatee is one of the most charismatic and instantly recognizable species, said Michael Bean, Deputy Assistant Secretary for Fish and Wildlife and Parks at the Department of Interior. It's hard to imagine the waters of Florida without them, but that was the reality we were facing before manatees were listed under the Endangered Species Act. While there is still more work to be done to fully recover manatee populations, their numbers are climbing and threats to the species' survival are being reduced. Now there's a 90-day comment period on the proposed change, when Fish and Wildlife Service will review any new information and make its final decision about the manatee's status. Federal protections and conservation efforts would not be cut off, the agency said. Even so, the move has critics, NPR member station WLRN reported. U.S. Representative Vern Buchanan of Sarasota sent a letter to the Fish and Wildlife Service asking it to withdraw the proposed status change, calling the move misguided and premature, and saying manatees face threats such as collisions from boats, habitat loss, and red tide. Meanwhile, 2015 has been a good year for another species in Florida, green sea turtles, as NBR reported on Morning Edition. At the Archie Carr National Wildlife Refuge in Florida, scientists counted 14,152 turtle nests last year. In 2001, there were 198. The species is generally classified as threatened, but breeding colonies in Florida and Pacific Coast of Mexico are listed as endangered. Lou Earhart is a professor emeritus at the University of Central Florida, and he's been working with sea turtles for more than 40 years. By all rights and what we know about extinction vortexes, they should have just slid into oblivion, but they didn't. Here's one example where we took action soon enough and the species responded, Earhart said. Decades-long conservation efforts are finally working, he stated. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is starting to consider upgrading the green sea turtles from endangered to threatened like the manatees. If you want more information, please visit www.earthfirstjournal.org/newswire. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update this week. The Earth First Update is presented on Free Radio, Santa Cruz 101.3 and www.freakradio.org every Thursday night at 9 p.m. And on Free Radio, you can hear a rebroadcast of the update on Fridays at 3 p.m. If you're in Moscow, Idaho, listen to KRFP Radio Free Moscow at 90.3 FM on 3 p.m. on Wednesdays. You can also listen to the Earth First Update on Truth and Justice Radio, WZBC in Boston, Massachusetts at 90.3 FM between 6 and 10 a.m. on Sundays. And Grateful Dread Public Radio, an internet radio station, is broadcasting the Earth First Update on Sundays at 2 a.m. Go to gdprnashville.org. That's gdprnashville.org, or you could also find them on tunein.com or spotify.com. You can also listen online or download the Earth First Update from radioforall.net. That's radio, the number, forall.net. Please ask your local nonprofit community radio station to air the Earth First Update every week. It is free to download and rebroadcast. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and is produced at Free Radio Santa Cruz. I want to thank you for listening and do tune in next week for another edition of the Earth First Update.